This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. A U.S. president has a unique view of the Constitution with the checks and balances it created. Philadelphia's public radio and television station WHYY, together with the National Center on the Constitution, ask NPR's Cokie Roberts to talk to the former president. Her discussions are part of a series on the Constitution. She went to the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, to interview former President Jimmy Carter.
Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter's inauguration in January 1977 came after the country had suffered through assassinations, war, and Watergate, and was ready, President Carter says, for someone from outside of Washington who trusted the American people. The brand new president decided that he needed to demonstrate that trust in the inaugural parade.
Rosa and I and the Secret Service were the only ones that knew in advance that we would stop the limousine, get out, and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. But it was a symbolic expression of my trust in my own integrity and in my own safety, on the one hand, and also a demonstration that there was no separation encapsulated in a big black limousine between the incumbent president and the people of our country.
That walk sent the signal that this president would be doing things differently, that he was going to try to shake up the status quo, which he did that first day in office by pardoning Vietnam draft evaders.
In a way, I thought bringing the constant and continuing altercation about the Vietnam War to a conclusion was important. Although I served 11 years of my life in the military, my father was in the First World War. My oldest son was in Vietnam. I thought that the best thing to do was to pardon them and get the Vietnam War behind us. And I think that's the main thing that President Ford thought, to get the Nixon issue behind him.
No other branch of government had any say over the power of the pardon. Neither did they about the president's next controversial act, inviting his wife to sit in on cabinet meetings.
Frozen permeated me with bombarded me with questions almost every evening at supper time about what's happening now. What does your cabinet members think? I told Rosa, why don't you sit in on the cabinet meetings in the background and you can hear what the debates are, and then you'll be
free. And then we can talk sports at dinner.
Then we can even watch a movie after dinner. So.
The president wanted the advice of his wife, who, Carter laughs, had no hesitation about confronting him. More than previous presidents, he also relied on the counsel of his vice president, Walter Mondale.
I was shocked to find out that no other vice president had ever been briefed on the use of a nuclear weaponry that would have to be used within 26 minutes if the United States was attacked. He was not even in the lineup, and no previous vice president had ever been included in the lineup. It went from the president to the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State.
Mondale, the former Minnesota senator, was an old Washington hand who could help the outsider president navigate the shoals of the city. Still, despite a Democratic majority in Congress, Carter found himself often at odds with the legislative branch, and he had to use every possible political ploy to convince the Senate to ratify the treaties ceding control of the Panama Canal. Having suffered through that battle, the president now sees the requirement that two-thirds of the Senate approve ratification as a mistake by the founding fathers.
I think that the presumption should be that the president is speaking for the country in concluding a treaty. But I would certainly approve the requirement that a majority of the Senate, a 51% vote, would be adequate to approve a treaty. But this way, one-third of the members of the Senate can block permanently any treaty that the president has concluded. I think that's a mistake.
While President Carter was working for ratification of the treaties, he was also grappling with the energy crisis, and he found that his views of another constitutional creation, federalism, changed as a result. He decided that the federal government had the right to take away from the states the ability to regulate the price of oil.
That issue about federal authority to mandate matters that over which the states had previously had control were constitutional in nature, and the Supreme Court and others have upheld the right of the federal government to have uniformity of oil and natural gas policy.
As a former governor, when you were there, how did you see federalism? Did your views of federalism change?
A great deal.
The great triumph of Jimmy Carter's presidency came in the field of foreign policy when he brought Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat to Camp David to hammer out a peace accord. It was a negotiation, he insists, that was well within his constitutional rights.
But there's no doubt that I negotiated at Camp David with Begin and Sadat very well aware that anything that I said at Camp David as a contribution of the United States of America would basically be upheld by the Congress, and that the President did have that authority to negotiate. So, yes, the President's right to conduct foreign affairs, to recognize any government in the world that he chooses, and to appoint diplomats and to withdraw them from the office on the spur of the moment, those kind of things are extremely important to the ability of a president to negotiate a peace agreement.
If Camp David was the triumph of the Carter administration, the Iranian hostage crisis was the tragedy. But the president did not feel constitutionally constrained from acting to free the Americans held in Tehran.
I sent the Ayatollah Khomeini a message from me that if you injure a hostage, we will terminate Iran's trade entirely with the outside world. And if you kill a hostage, we will take military action against your country. And I sent this message to Khomeini, I believe, through 7 different channels, primarily the German government and the Swiss government and others, to make sure he got the message. He never injured a hostage, and he never threatened to kill a hostage as a response to that.
Though he's convinced he had every right to launch a military attack, the president knew a strike would mean the death of the hostages, so he negotiated for their release, which finally happened as soon as Carter was out of office. He got word during the inauguration of Ronald Reagan.
I had people ready to come and tell me, when did the plane take off? And I think 5 minutes after 12, the plane took off and all the hostages were free. One of the happiest moments of my life.
That inauguration was one of many in recent years where the outgoing president must sit on the same platform celebrating the ascendancy of the man who defeated him. Jimmy Carter himself had beaten President Gerald Ford, who has now become a good friend and ally in many causes. President Carter believes it's the Constitution that made that friendship possible.
And I think the U.S. Constitution and its relatively unchanging nature for more than 200 years has been the foundation on which we can survive a very unpleasant election on occasion and a deeply grieved loss and an exhilarating victory. And we all feel that we're still part of a team.
Former President Jimmy Carter on the Constitution. I'm Cokie Roberts.
Check your local public television and radio listings for all of the Jimmy Carter interview, which you can also hear on NPR.org. Next week, another conversation on the Constitution with George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush.